How much else we might tell of this year when, out of pride and shame, Moot was still hiding her love from Joseph, and even from the outer world was still thinking that she hid it. Her own struggle against her feelings, the struggle with herself, carried on for a while with such violence, was over, and for better or worse, the feelings had won. Now she only fought to conceal her state before men and before the beloved himself. For in her soul she gave herself more utterly to this new marvel, with the more rapture, one might say with the more simplicity, in that she had been before so ignorant of it, had remained so long the elegant saint and cool, worldly moon nun before she had awakened to feeling. With the deeper revulsion, she now looked back upon those times unblessed by passion. She could not find herself again in their aridity. She shrank from a return to them with all the strength of her awakened femininity. The intoxicating enhancement which fullness of love can bring to a life like hers is well known, though indescribable. But gratitude for that blessing of desire and torture seeks an object, and finds it only in him from whom it all proceeds, or seems to proceed. Is it any wonder, then, that fulfillment in him, increased by gratitude, becomes adoration? We have seen that there were brief, uncertain moments in which Joseph seemed half, or even more than half, a god. But were those momentary promptings to be called idolatry? For so much positive rapture, so much finality lies in the word, as the logic of love understands it. That is a logic strange and audacious enough. He who has done this so it runs to my life, he who has given to the once dead this burning and freezing, this jubilation and these tears, he must be a god. Nothing else is possible. Actually, he has done nothing, and everything proceeds from the possessed one herself. But she will not believe it. With prayers of gratitude, she creates out of her own rapture the other's godhead. O paradise of feeling, thou hast made rich my life. It burgeons. That was a prayer, a fragment of one of Moot M. Ennett's prayers of gratitude, addressed to Joseph as she knelt at the end of her couch when no one saw her, stammering and weeping. But why, with her life so rich and burgeoning, why was she more than once on the point of sending her Nubian slave for the asp, that she might put it to her bosom? Yes, why had she once even given the order, and had the viper already at hand in the little reed basket, and had only at the last moment desisted from her purpose? Well, because she was convinced that she had at their last meeting spoiled everything, and not only looked ugly, but had by her look and her trembling betrayed to her lover her love, the love of an ugly old woman, after which there was nothing left but to die, so punishing herself and him, and by her death revealing to him the secret for whose betrayal she had sentenced herself. Oh, muddled, fantastic logic of love! So familiar it is hardly worth telling, so old that it was already old in the time of Potiphar's wife, and seems new only to those who, like her, are in the throes of what they believe to be a unique experience. She whispered, "O hearken, music! A ghost of sound breathes blissful on my ear." That is familiar, too. It is the aural delusion of the ecstatic, which visits the love-intoxicated as well as the god-intoxicated, and indicates that the two states are related and mingled, the one having much of the divine, the other of the human. Familiar, too, so that we need not go into detail, are those fevered nights, taken up with a sequence of brief dreams, in which the other is always present and turns coldly and suspiciously away. A succession of meetings with his image, wretched, crushing, yet tirelessly resumed by the slumberous soul between constant abrupt wakings. The sufferer starts up, wrestles for breath, makes light. "O God! O God! How can it be? How can such torments exist?" But does she fly from him, the author of such nights? By no means. When morning releases her from agony, she sits exhausted on the edge of her bed, and sends a whisper thence to where he is, "I thank thee, my joy, my star, my salvation." The well-wishing friend can but shake his head at such a reaction to such frightful anguish. He feels confused, even made a fool of, by his pity for her. But when the author and giver of the anguish is thought of as not human but divine, then the reaction is possible and natural. The authorship is shared between the I and the you, so that though it seem bound up with the one, yet at the same time it is localized in the other, consisting in the enlacement and union of an inward and an outward, an image and a soul, a marriage, that is, such as has before now had gods as issue, and can thus, without absurdity, be spoken of as divine in its manifestations. A being whom we bless for the tortures he inflicts must be a god, not a man, else we should curse him. A certain logicality cannot be denied. A being upon whom depends all the joy and sorrow of our days, for that is love, belongs in the ranks of the divine. Nothing could be clearer, for this dependence is the very essence of an awareness of God. But has anybody ever yet cursed his God? It has been tried, perhaps, but then the curse turned into something else. What it sounded like, we have heard. All this for the consolation of the well-wishing friend, if not perhaps altogether to his satisfaction. But had our Amy not a peculiar justification for making a god out of her beloved? Surely, for thus she got rid of the humiliation otherwise inseparable from her weakness for a foreign slave, with which she had struggled so long. A god from above, taking on a slave's shape, only apparent by his undisguisable beauty and his shoulders golden bronze. She evoked this idea out of her thought world, and most happily, for it was the explanation and excuse for her state. But the hope that her dream might be fulfilled, that dream of healing when he had opened her eyes and stanched her blood, that hope was nourished by another and more remote vision, which likewise she discovered in her own mind. It was the vision of a mortal overshadowed by a god. It may well be that in her groping back to so fantastic a conception lay some of the anguish she felt when her husband made his revelations about Joseph's consecrated state and the meaning of the garland that he wore. The second year. With the coming of the second year, something gave way in Mut M. Enet's soul, so that she began to let Joseph see her love. She could no longer help it. She loved him too much. At the same time, and in consequence, she began to confide her state to certain persons in her entourage. Not quite to Dudu, for indeed she well knew that his sun-brightened wits had found it out long before. Besides, despite the change in her, it would have gone against her pride to admit it to him. They abode by their old understanding, that she was seeking to discover the source of the magic practiced by the foreign slave in order to bring him to a fall. This was the established phrase, becoming less equivocal from day to day. But there were two women whom she suddenly made her confidants, she who had never had confidants before, so that they were not a little exalted by the honor. She confided in each separately. The concubine Mek En Weset, a lively little person, arrayed in transparent garments with flowing hair, and an old rubber-eater, Tabubu by name, slave of the toilette table and the rouge pots, gray of hair, black of skin, with sagging breasts like leather wineskins. To these two, Amy opened her heart in whispers, after her behavior had been such that they began to wheedle her for its cause. She so sighed, that is, and smiled, and sat plunged in such obvious daydreaming, that the two women, one beside the basin in the court, the other at the toilette table, implored her to tell them the reason. For a while she still twisted and turned, but then, as though overtaken by a seizure, she confessed her state to them, murmuring in their ears with drunken tongue, while they shuddered too. Though they may have guessed before, by putting this and that together, they now held up their hands or covered their faces, kissed her hands and feet, and cooed over her solemnly and tenderly, almost as though she had told them she was with child. In such wise did these women receive the great news, so important to their sex, that Mut, the mistress, found herself in love. They became very busy with consolation and congratulations, stroking the afflicted one as though her body had become the vessel of some precious and perilous thing, displaying in all sorts of ways their fearful delight with the turn of affairs, the great transformation, the opening of a time of feminine mysteries and joys, sweet deceptions, and the enhancement of the daily round by intrigue. Black Tabubu, who knew all sorts of Negro magic and how to conjure up forbidden gods, was all for practicing her arts to subject the youth and bring him to her mistress's feet a blissful prey. But the daughter of Mi-Sakme, the prince of the gnome, rejected the idea with disgust, for the present. Displaying a higher stage of civilization than the woman from Kush, and also the decency of her own feelings, however suspect they really were. On the other hand, Mech, the concubine, thought not of magic, considering such practices beside the mark. Surely the matter, aside from the danger of it, was simple enough. "Blissful one," said she, "why sigh? Is not the handsome youth the bought slave of this house, although set over it, and your property from the very first? If you would have him, what have you else to do but beckon? He cannot but consider it the greatest honor to put his head and feet to yours for your rejoicing." "For the sake of the Hidden One," whispered Moot, hiding her face, "speak not so openly, for you know not what you say, and it rives my heart." She could not chide the simple soul, for she knew, with a certain envy, that the concubine was pure and free from love and love's guilty desires, and so might speak with good conscience of putting heads and feet together, however it anguished her mistress to hear her. Moot went on, "One can see you were never in such a state, my child. Never have you been hurried and harried, but might spend your time munching and prattling with your sisters in Petipre's house of women. Else you could not say that I have but to lift my eyebrow. You would know that in my love the state of mistress and slave is cancelled out, even if not reversed. Rather I hang upon his gloriously penciled brows to see if they are smooth and pleasant, and not bent with amazement and reproof upon my quaking form. Lo, you are no better than the base Tabubu, who would have me practice black magic with her, that the youth might fall victim in the flesh and in all innocence. For shame, you ignorant ones, who with your advice thrust a sword into my heart and turn it round. For you speak as though he were but body, and not soul and spirit to boot. And over these, my beckoning would have no power, no more than magic, for both can only command the body, and bring me only that, a living corpse. Were he ever mine, obedient to the beckoning of my brow, then by my love he hath his freedom, his full freedom, foolish Mech, and I give up my sovereignty with joy, and wear his yoke, enslaved in bliss and torment to his living soul. This is the truth, and I suffer endlessly that it is not daylight truth, but that he must by day be ever the slave, and under my orders. For when he calls me sovereign of his head and heart, his hands and feet, I cannot tell whether he speaks in the phrases of a slave, or perhaps as a living soul. I hope the latter, but am ever fearful. Heed what I say. If his mouth were all, then might I listen in my need to what you say of beckonings and magic, for the mouth is of the body. But there is the lovely night of his eyes, speaking freedom and the soul. Ah, how I specially fear that freedom, for that it may be freedom from the longing which thralls me, the lost one, in its sullen bondage. Perhaps he laughs at me. Perhaps not just at me, but at my longing, so that I am shamed and ruined. For my admiration of his freedom but heightens my longing and weaves my bonds the tighter. Can you understand that, my Mech? And more, I must fear the anger of his eyes and his rejection of me, because my feeling for him is a betrayal of Petipre, the courtier, his master and mine, to whom he is loyal, in whom he labors to keep self-esteem erect. While I would tempt him to shame the master upon my heart. All this I read in his threatening eyes, from which you can see that it has to do with more than his mouth, and that he is more than body. For a man who is only body would not be involved in entanglements which condition him as well as our relation to him, and make it difficult by weighing it down with all sorts of considerations and consequences, turning it into a question of rules and honor and moral precepts, and cutting the wings of our desire so that it limps along the ground. How much, Mech, by night and day, have I pondered on these things? For a body is free and single, has no reference, and for love's purpose we need be only bodies, swinging free in space and embracing each other without care or consequence, mouth on mouth with closed eyes. That would be bliss, and yet bliss which I reject. For can I wish that the beloved should be a detached body, a corpse, not a person? That I cannot, for I love not alone his mouth. I love his eyes, them most of all. And thus your counsels are repellent to me, yours and Tabubu's, and I reject them with impatience. I cannot understand, said Mech the concubine, your tangled imaginings. I thought, since you love him, the only matter was to put your heads and feet together for your enjoyment. As though simply this were not, after all, the final goal of her longings, the longings of Mut-em-Enet, the lovely Mut-emone. The thought that her feet, so restless in Joseph's presence, might rest nestled close to his. The thought enraptured her and shook her to her very depths. When Mech-en-Weset gave it words, without having spent a tithe of thought upon it compared to Mut, she encouraged the inward yielding, of which her disclosures to her women had been a sign, and she began to betray to the young steward her fallen state, in word and deed. The deeds were significant, if also childlike in kind, and even touching. Small attentions from the mistress to the servant, who found it not easy to put the right face upon their true meaning. For instance, one day, and often afterwards, she received him in Asiatic dress, a rich garment, the stuff for which she had bought in the city of the living, at the shop of a bearded Syrian. Her slave, the dressmaker Hetti, had made it up. It had much more color than Egyptian wear, in fashion like two pieces of embroidered woolen stuff, one blue and one red, wound together and bordered with colored braid. It was extravagant and exotic. The shoulders were covered by the lappets proper to the style, and on top of the embroidered and gaily colored headband, called sanip in its native land, Aene had thrown the indispensable headcloth, reaching below her hips. Thus clad, she looked at Joseph, her eyes widened both by the application of Galena and by an expectation half-mischievous, half-concerned. "How strange! Yet how splendid you look, my lady," said he, betraying his understanding by an embarrassed smile. "Strange?" she asked, smiling too, but her smile, though tender, was forced and confused. "Familiar, I should rather think. Do I not appear as a daughter of your own land in this garb, which for a change I put on today? If indeed it be my garb you have in mind."